the subway map matters more than just a navigation tool, because it gives us a picture of the city we live in. Every map is a poem, a visual poem in a way. It's a story, it's a narrative about one person's understanding of what's out there.
Welcome to A Journey with Purpose, episode 29. I'm your host, Randy Plummel. If we haven't met, I'm a trained architect who left the profession to help design great experiences for the public sector at my small but mighty design firm, Expedition Works. An expedition is just a journey with purpose. And in dense cities, those journeys often require us to take buses, subways, all sorts of things. Today, we speak with a New York City subway map expert, Peter Lloyd, about the evolution of the map and why we should care about it at all. Special thanks to the always amazing New York Transit Museum for allowing us to record at the museum before it opened. To begin with, tell us your name, where we're sitting right now, and what do you do?
I'm Peter Lloyd, and right now we're in the New York Transit Museum, one of the beautiful vintage cars, and we're going to talk about the map. This is one of them behind me, the subway map of 1979, and the history of these maps goes on and on. There's so many interesting nuances that have affected the map over the years.
So this is a loaded question, but what makes a good subway or transit map?
I'm often asked the question of what makes a good subway map or what's my favorite subway. These are mythical questions. There's no answer to them. There is no magic ingredient that makes a map really good. Maps have different functions. It may be just to navigate from one station to another station. And usually diagrams are the best for that because they have minimal clutter. There's no additional information in there. Or you might want to know how to get to a certain place in the city. And there you would want a geographic map that shows the subway system embedded in the context of the city. So there isn't a simple answer to the question, what makes a good map? But on top of those basic considerations, there's also other purposes of a map, such as being an icon for the city. You see a London Tube map, see, that's London. You see a Paris Metro map, that's Paris. You see the New York map, hey, that's New York. So it has an iconic function. In addition to actually navigating the system, is also a means of selling the system. The MTA wants people to use the subway. So having an attractive map, beautiful map, is a way to bring people in. There are lots of barriers to using the subway. People usually prefer to use their automobiles or a taxi. The subway helps preserve the planet, reduces pollution. And so there's an obligation on the MTA to get people in to use the subway. And having good information, beautiful signage, is one way to do that. So the multiple layers of purpose of a map, and hence there's no simple answer to the question, what makes a good map?
So New York City, over the course of the life of the system, it's gone through a series of changes. It used to be multiple systems, now it's one system. It has had multiple maps, some of them diagrammatic, some of them geographic. There seems to be some chapters of the arc of the history. Can you give us some ideas of the changes?
In looking at the history of the New York subway map, it's important to remember there's no grand narrative. It isn't a story. This is real life, and they're real people who've had influences on the map at different times. And it's really been driven by individuals' vision of what the map and the signage should look like. If you go back to the beginning, 1904, subway first opened, it's a fairly simple system. There weren't any pocket maps. You couldn't go to a station and say, hey, give me a pocket map for the subway. It didn't exist. It was only 1924 when the IRT, the Interborough Rapid Transit, had a rival, the Brooklyn-Manhattan Transit. Then we start to see pocket maps appear. And each of those two companies had its own pocket map that excluded its rival. So the IRT map did not show BT map, did not show IRT. Now those maps were, there's a certain continuum of diagrammicity from a pure diagram to a satellite photograph. And these were pretty much along the spectrum towards geographical realism. There was a certain amount of abstraction in them. They didn't show the full network of streets, but you could see where the main topographic features were in them. In 1932, the IND brought a new network into play, and there was a new map brought out, which initially was very simple. Again, it was semi-geographical. But there's a guy called Arthur Weindorf, who mostly worked with models, building models of subway stations. But he also had a hand in maps, subway maps, since 1918. And he started having brilliant ideas about how to make a diagram of the IND system that was his area. And this was really very Vignelli-esque. I mean, I refer to Vignelli because that's like a reference point. Everyone knows the Vignelli map. So when I say Weindorf's map was Vignelli-esque, you can picture it. There's actually a very rare color version of Weindorf's map here in the Transmuseum, which nobody gets to see because it's super fragile. But there's a photograph on display. And that's an amazing piece of work. It shows a clear separation of the services within the IND system, color-coded. Now, there were other versions of that in black and white, which appeared on the subway cars and on the subway stations, which show, again, a diagrammatic representation, but without color, just black and white. So the services were labeled as GG and so on. Now, that map did not survive. Arthur Weindorf put forward a new proposal to extend his diagrammatic concept to the whole network in 1943. But at the same time, it was then the Board of Transportation had been formed, which took over all of those three networks, the IND, BMT, and the IRT, under one roof. And there was a concern then to produce a combined map showing all three systems. But they didn't really want to commission someone to do it because there was already a map out there on the streets. There were several contenders. The biggest one was Andrew Hagstrom. He was really the leader in subway maps. Andrew Hagstrom, as well as having the best map in many regards, was an incredibly powerful businessman. He really had a lot of drive. And so he went to the Board of Transportation and said, you really need to use my map to show your riders where all these lines are. And they agreed. So 1943, they printed their information on the back of the map. So it was his map with the Board of Transportation's information on it. And that unfortunately knocked out Arthur Weindorf. He had a very systematic map, a very clear map, which could have gone forward to produce a diagram of the whole system, but he was beaten by the business acumen of Andrew Hagstrom. And the next year, Arthur Weindorf retired, and that was the end of that whole line of possible evolution of the map. Andrew Hagstrom was then pushed further, and he got the permission to do, or the contract to do, the station map. This was about this big, and it showed the entire network, and it was the first time the subway system had a combined map in every station in the network, which is a huge step forward. Previously, each station you went to would have a map just of that network. Now you have everywhere a common map. And it backed him a lot of money, like $70,000, which is a lot of money at that time, bought a new office with it. And those maps stayed there for a long time. They were still visible in the 70s, long after they'd become really up to date. And then the following year, 1948, car maps were produced. So Hagstrom then had a supreme position, pocket maps, station maps, car maps. Also, he got a deal to put in every telephone directory. There were also promotional ones for banks and hotels. He was everywhere. And he used the fact that he was the official map maker for the subway system. It's advertising. You look in newspapers at the time, says, buy a copy of the official subway map. That era from 1943 up to the late 50s is the Hagstrom golden era. Now, what happened in the 50s is 1953, the Board of Transportation is replaced by Transit Authority. And they've got a different attitude towards things. Now, there's a guy called George Salomon, who was a German emigre, who spent some time in London, loved the London system, loved the London map, the signage, and he hated the New York subway system. I mean, he loved the system, but the wayfinding really got to him, especially as he was a foreigner arriving in the country, didn't know English that well. And so he started developing his own concepts of a complete nomenclature change, signage, map, and he made detailed notes about all this. He was really doing what Unimark did 20 years later, of going on every station, making notes on where the signage should be. A lot of that information is lost, but his proposals about the map are right here in the Transit Museum archives. And one of his suggestions was, let's go towards a diagram. He loved the London diagram, said, let's do one like that. He also wanted to change the colors into trunk colors, but the TA did not want to go that far. It would be too expensive. They said, okay, we do need to have an in-house map. We don't want to keep spending money buying a Hagstrom map. If it's in-house, we reduce the costs, have control of updates. So they went for it. So in December 1958, the first official diagram of the entire system came out. And people were happy with it. I don't see anything in the newspaper, letters column or anywhere, people criticizing it. They accepted it. It's a valid map. It's a clear map. And that carried on for about 10 years or so. The next big change, the next revolution in the strata of the archaeology of the subway map is the late 60s. Now, there's a certain amount of congestion in certain parts of the system, like DeKalb Avenue. To relieve that congestion, they built a tunnel under Christie Street. And that happened to connect the IND network with the BMT network, two of the three networks.
Okay, I want to cut in here. For those of us who struggle with all the acronyms IND, BMT, and IRT and don't have it fully memorized, what Peter is talking about here is that the MTA dug a new 7-ish block tunnel under Christie Street, which services the current B&D line, which comes off the Manhattan Bridge, and the M train, which comes off the Williamsburg Bridge. Since the Christie Street cut or Christie Street connection has been built, the MTA has used it in different ways, but the upshot of it is that it's allowed much more flexibility and different configurations of how we move about the city. Okay, back to Peter.
By the way, even though everything's now under one control, physically, the networks are still separate. There weren't any connections until late 60s when they built this tunnel. That was great for the system because it meant they could relieve the congestion, move trains around much more fluidly. But it's a nightmare for the map makers. So until this time, the subway maps always had just three colors, one color for the IRT, one for BMT, one for IND. Now, if two of those networks are going to be connected, you can't use a three-color scheme. Some people tried it, but it was ridiculous. You'd have a green line suddenly turning red. It didn't make any sense. So what are we going to do about the map in that situation? Well, TA didn't know. So they said, open it up to the subway map contest, public contest. There were three winners, one of whom went forward with his report to the final stages, and that was Raleigh D'Adamo. And his great idea was, well, instead of just these three colors, why don't we have a separate color for each end-to-end route? Then you get complete information about which route is going where. You don't have to worry about Christie Street. And they accepted this. Now, his specific idea, because he understood the requirements very strictly of making a geographic map. And he said the only way to get 14 different service lines drawn in Manhattan would be to alternate colors. So let's say on Lexington Avenue, three different services. So you have three colors alternating along the line rather than three parallel ones. That was very difficult to achieve in the printing technology at the time because you need perfect registration to avoid those tiny little color blocks merging with each other. So what they actually did in 1967, which is when Christie Street opened, is to create a map which was pretty much diagrammatic and drew those services in parallel lines. Now, the guy who came after Raleigh, which is Stanley Goldstein, Hofstra University, he said there are a number of ways of interpreting Raleigh's concept. One way is to use trunk colors, and then you have to indicate at each station, list out all of the services that stop there. So let's say Lexington Avenue. If you draw that as one line, then at each station you have to say which of the four, five, and six stop there. Or alternatively, his other proposal was to draw each line separately. So each line would have its own color and be drawn separately. And the TA said, let's do both, which is really information overload. So you get the same information twice on the map, once as separate colored lines and once as a list of services at each station. And that came out in 1967. And it was a mess. The whole thing was pretty much a disaster, partly because the signage took years to change. It still referred to all of the old lines, the IRT, BMT, NT. You walk into a station and your map says, these are the colored routes, the Q and the QJ. And you look around, there's no signage about that. Or you look on the cars and there's no signage there matching. So that was part of the confusion. But also the map itself was overloaded with information. Very complicated. It's great to have that information, but too much duplication. So just a few years later, 1970, the Transit Authority had commissioned Unimark International to develop new signage, which was really urgently needed to improve wayfinding around the subway. And then in 1970, they said, okay, you've done the signage, now we want a new map. And Massimo Vignelli was the director of Unimark in New York, And he looked at the existing map and said, this is very fragmented. You've got a lot of what he calls fake information. So you've got one set of information, the colored lines, another layer of information, same information in the station box. And he said, no, it's fake information. It looks like information, it's just noise. So he cut out all those boxes, all those lists of services, and he reduced it back down to what really was Stanley Goldstein's other prototype of having a nice, clean map with just one drawn line for each route, no list of stations, and he followed the no dot, no stop rule. If you look along the lines where there's a dot, train stops there. So transfers had no special symbolism. You just looked along the lines, and if you saw that two adjacent lines had dots, you could change. You could make a transfer. If not, then not. Very simple. Very loved simplicity. He was really hooked on minimalism. And so that map came out in 1972. And a lot of people think of this as like the big revolution, that this is the first diagram and Neil catered it. These are all myths. Neil had already been using a diagram since 1958 without any trouble. And they continue using the Vignelli diagram without difficulty. The New York subway is a difficult thing to get around anyway. Even if you know it, it tricks you. So the fact that people got lost using the Vignelli map is not surprising. People are getting lost with the other maps. So yeah, there are always people who hate it. Always people get lost with the previous diagrams.
Why do you think there's this mythology around everybody hated the Unimark Vignelli map?
People tend to operate within social bubbles. So if you're someone who loves minimalism, loves cool modern designs, your other friends and colleagues are also going to be people who love cool modern designs. But if you're outside of that bubble, you like more traditional maps, maps where the parks are green, the water's blue, then all your friends are going to be people who don't like the diagram. So people tend to say, oh, everybody in the 70s hated Vignelli, or everybody in the 70s loved Vignelli. And so people latch onto this idea that everybody else thinks like they do. But the hard data of the merchandise imprinted with the Vignelli map in the 70s indicates it was very popular. The MTA made about $43,000 a year selling Vignelli merchandise. It was popular. People loved it. They still love it. Still a huge icon. The reason why it was jettisoned was not because of this notion that there was an upwell of rising. People, the myths about there being thousands of letters of complaint. I've looked through the newspapers at the time. I found two letters expressing opinions about the Vignelli map, one praising it, one criticizing it. People criticized about the system about other things: dirt, danger, crime, unreliability, noise. One newspaper had a list of call-ins of people saying, please phone our number and say what you would like to change or improve in the subway. The map isn't anywhere. Or this, the design of the map. The last one says, we want more maps. We go into a station, there's no map there. No one's complaining about the subway map in the 70s. The Vignelli map is accepted as being a valid map, showing you where the system is. The system is complex. You can get lost, but this is no worse than any other map. So why did it change? Why is it that the MTA spent 4 years with a committee to create a new map that threw away the entire Vignelli map? Now, there was a big debate in 1978 between Massimo Vignelli and the chairman of the committee that was producing the map. And you might think this would be an opportunity for the MTA to gauge public opinion, to propose a change, and then see whether people liked it or not. No. The MTA were already decided they were going to ditch the Vignelli map. And John Toranak, later an interview question, I asked him, would it have made any difference if all these criticisms about the Vignelli map being inaccurate had been corrected? If all the things you didn't like about Vignelli had been changed the park to green, changed the waters to blue, moved 50th Street, then none. It wouldn't have made any difference. The Vignelli map was dead. It was doomed. And so the MTA's use of that debate was really as a show trial. It was giving people a chance to look at the different arguments, but the conclusion was foregone. I think the people in the audience at the time sensed that they had been ambushed by the MTA. We had this big debate, which historically is very valuable in giving insight into people's positions, into the opinions, and why people put forward different ideas. But it wasn't actively going to change anything. So the MTA then carried on during 1978 to develop the map. The big problem that John Tornack faced, the same as George Salomon faced, is how to compress that information, all those different services, into Manhattan, which is very narrow. And what he wanted to do is to move from a root color map to a trunk color map. So in the root color map, the Vanelli map, each service is drawn to a separate colored line. It goes back to 67. What John wanted to do is to compress that so that each trunk in Manhattan, like Lexington Avenue, like 7th Avenue, had its own color. And then the branches, it's like a tree, branches at the top, branches at the bottom, retain that color, but they indicate where the routes are going. But to do that on the map, you would have to change the signage to match the same color. So you've got three different colored lines in Lexington Avenue. If you're going to change that on the map, you have to change that in all the stations and all the cars. And the MTA at that time was laying off staff. It was deferring maintenance. It had no money. The city had no money. The city was almost bankrupt. Luckily for the map, for John, in 1978, the federal government gave New York a whole pot of money. Some of that money came to the MTA. And luckily, Phyllis Cerf Wagner had been assigned as the chair of the aesthetics committee. Her main role was beautifying stations, repainting them, making things look nice. But within her remit, she decided that improving the map was one of her tasks. And so she made some money available for John's project of recoloring the subway. So suddenly, this project, which had been languished about 4 years, could move forward with great speed. Suddenly, it was possible for John to impose his great vision of a trunk-colored map on the system. And that's what happened. So very quickly, the colors were chosen, and they were chosen economically. So on each trunk of Manhattan, they chose a color which had the largest number of existing stations. So that reduced the number of stations that had to be changed. Save a bit of money. It's still expensive, but save some money. And then in June 79, the new map came out without much fanfare. Some of the people on the committee wanted to do more testing, more user testing, to see whether people could really find a way around more easily with this map. But Harold Fisher said, no, we need to get this map out as part of the 75th anniversary of the subway system. Do it now. Stop testing. Stop faffing around. Just get the map out there. So out it came. And as before, some people liked it. Some people didn't like it. It certainly had a lot more information in than the Vanelli map. A lot more detail. When I say information, I mean things like where the routes change at nighttime or on weekends. Vanelli's map made it very hard to figure out how the map changed at night. The Tornack map, it's not trivial to find out where you're going at nighttime. The information was there, it was more accessible. And that was the last big revolution in the map. And going on from 1979, there have been various changes. They've gotten the nighttime map, the large typeface map. There's lots of improvements in the structure of Manhattan. Fatter. Certain times the bus information, bus links were put into little balloons, but fundamentally it's the same map. John calls it, the new map is built on the dry bones of his map. He's very attached to his map, and so any deviations from it he's not too happy about, but really it's the same map. But then in 2008, there was a reawakening of the Vanelli School. Men's Vogue magazine wanted to do a special issue about design icons. And so they asked Vanelli if he would redo his map or do a special version of the map for their magazine. And he'd actually been pondering the questions for some years about how he would do the map differently now. And obviously one big change are the colors. Back in the original 72 map, as we said, each line has their own color. By 2008, that wasn't the case anymore. Lexington Avenue was green. So he was thinking about how he would do his map, retaining the new colors, but still keeping it as a route map. And his idea was just to draw the three services in Lexington Avenue, all green, side by side, but still showing where they go. So that was the map that came out as a charitable exercise. Then shortly afterwards, in 2011, the MTA said, well, look, we need to have some graphical means of showing what happens on the weekend when a lot of lines are taken out of service for maintenance. And then someone had the idea, hang on a minute, this is what Vanelli did in the 70s. So they gave him a call and said, look, would you be interested in doing a new map for us? And they said, yeah, I've already done it. And so by amazing coincidence, what he'd already worked on for Men's Vogue turned out to be exactly what the MTA now wanted for weekend. but we'd also moved away from the paper era to the digital era. And the map is perfect for that because they could show by ghosting out certain routes, certain lines, which services were out of order. So on Lexington Avenue, if number 4 was out of order, ghosted out. And so we then had the Weekender website on the MTA, which showed this basically a Vignelli diagram. This was done with Yoshiko Waterhouse and Beatrice Fender's Vignelli Associates. And everyone saw this as a revival of the Vignelli map. And they're still using that in digital formats and the screens and the stations on the website. It's changed quite a bit now. There's added various tweaks. Steve Flam's been doing a lot of work on it. But it's still basically, people see that, oh, it's a Vignelli map. Even though Vignelli obviously has passed away now and there's nothing to do with it, but it's built on his concepts. They can still see the Toronac map or the Neo-Toronac map. So we now have two streams of cartography going on in the subway, which actually seems crazy, but it makes sense because each one has its pros and cons. The Toronac geographic map shows you where the subway is in relation to the city. The diagram shows you the optimum way to get from A to B. It's a very clear, clean diagram. What's going to happen next? Who knows?
I'd like for you to reflect, why do we care about this? Why should we, or why should we as either fans of maps and design, or even just like normal people trying to get around the subway, why does this matter?
I think the subway map matters more than just a navigation tool, because it gives us a picture of the city we live in. Like you look in the mirror and you see your face, and this is your identity. And you look on the map and say, this is the city you live in, you're invested in, you pay your taxes towards. And so it's a visual representation of your environment, your roots, the place that you fell in love, that you went to school, you went to college, you work in. It's packaging up a lot of connections, social connections, memories, and then putting a stamp on it. This map shows you this whole package of your life that you've spent in this city. And so I think it is more than just a tool for navigating. It's an iconic representation of a chunk of your life. And I think that's why it really matters. When people change the map, they take it personally. They feel this is part of you that's being messed around with. I think this is why John Toronac really hated the Vignelli map, because he loves it. He spent a lot of years studying the architecture, the history of the place, like walking around. He was a tour guide for many years. He feels the city is part of him. And then when he saw the Vignelli map and Central Park reduced to a gray blob, then he said, no, you can't do that to my beloved city. And Vignelli had a very different attitude. He loved the system of the subway's connections. And so it didn't matter to him whether the park was gray or green or blue or whatever. And so his sense of New York City was an interconnection where all parts, all the boroughs are equal. And wherever you are in New York, you're still part of that integrated system. People have a different idea of what New York is, but for anyone, the map can function as a representation of it. Every map is a poem, a visual poem in a way. It's a story, it's a narrative about one person's understanding of what's out there. And you can tune into it all or not.
My thanks again to Peter Loy for the crash course in all things New York City subway maps. And this was the short version. You can see his scholarship online at peterloy.com and other places. We put his info in the show notes. My additional thanks to Regina Shepherd and the New York Transit Museum, who graciously made space available for us to conduct this interview. This has been episode 29 of Journey with Purpose. I would be remiss not to note that next week is the 2024 election day here in the States. I already voted, and I urge all registered voters to vote, and I urge you to vote for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. We aren't going back. I work with and for the public sector in part because Donald Trump orchestrated a legislative coup and fomented an insurrection because he couldn't stand that he lost. His administration and how he conducted himself, both in office and out of office, is a stain on our country, and anyone connected to his administration should be called to account for enabling his actions. That being said, all views and comments by myself don't necessarily reflect the views of our employers, employees, or clients. This is my personal view. I want you to vote, I would prefer you to vote for Vice President Harris. If you care about things like personal safety, personal autonomy, things like moving around the city in a free and open way, I would urge you to vote for the Vice President. We wish you safety and wellness, and please do understand the assignment when you vote. See you on the internets.